Hark, Junkions, and behold, another biblical episode of Junk Food Cinema brought to you by FilmSchoolRejects.com. Dot Old Testament. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and I'm joined, as per usual, by my friend and co-host. He's a novelist, he's a screenwriter, he's a lieutenant of Megaforce, he may, in fact, bring about End of Days, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
And by that I mean you're going to bring around your copy of End of Days starring Arnold Schwarzenegger.
On VHS.
And VHS, and we will probably watch it. How are you today?
I'm great.
Man, we are
I'm deep in summer of 88, man.
We are, it's so crazy, like, we knew we were going to do it, but we weren't sure we were going to do it. We kicked things off with Die Hard, and this week, we have a movie that has a decidedly less pop culture impact than Die Hard.
Also has a connection to Die Hard.
This is very true.
Because at the time that Die Hard was made, Bruce Willis was married to a young lady named Demi Moore.
And we will get more into that in just a moment.
We will get more into that. We will get into more later.
It's a second language to me now. I'm doing this stuff on accident. I'm glad you're here to point them out because I literally just don't notice anymore. I've dropped so many puns in my life that it just happens now and I'm not even aware. It's like a reflex. Like, if you hit me in the knee, I'm going to probably do a Christopher Walken impression and drop a pun. It's a reflex. It just happens. And if you just so happen to want to hear more of us, you can go to our back catalog on Blog Talk Radio or iTunes. And if you're on iTunes, why not give us a 5-star rating and leave a review? We love to hear from you. Thank you so very much. You can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema or like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/, Junk Food Cinema. And if you really like the show, find yourself quoting it more than you quote the good book. And by the good book, I of course mean Building Empires, the book about the Empire Strikes Back.
Star Grove.
Patreon.com/junkfoodcinema is a great way for you to financially support the show. I am happy to announce that we are so close to hitting our next stretch goal, which was $700 an episode. You guys are incredible. And that means that once we hit that goal, Cargill and I will be doing a monthly live show with patrons where we basically just shoot the shit online with you, so that will be a lot of fun.
And we'll just kind of Facebook Live with drinks.
Yeah, that's pretty much how it's going to work out. And I don't think either one of us is against the idea of finding another excuse to drink and be online. So, hey, everybody wins. And speaking of everybody wins, nobody wins when you're dealing with the end of the world. And that's exactly what this week's movie does. Another Summer of 88 installment, The Seventh Sign.
The time is coming.
I can't wait 2 months to go.
The signs are beginning.
Found this.
It's incredible.
The seals are breaking. The day is approaching.
Hello.
Hi.
The mystery is unfolding.
Well, I need to know what this says. I need to know what language it is.
It's about the apocalypse.
Your baby's due in February, the 29th.
How'd you know that?
There's a whole chain of signs, like a countdown. The Bible's filled with them.
One of the signs has to be stopped.
What how, Mrs. Quinn? Do you know how?
It's time for you to know, Abby.
Stay away!
There's nothing you can do. You can't stop it.
Show me you have hope, Abby.
Stop!
Demi Moore in The Seventh Sign.
This was on our maybe list, and this was something I wanted to revisit. I saw this when it came out. This was part of a spate of Catholic-geared horror movies that came out. There's two in particular that I think are notable in 1988. This is one of them. I'm hoping we will cover the second, which is called The Unholy with Ben Cross, which is another forgotten,
cool as fuck
Catholic horror film.
So forgotten that I don't even know that one.
It's really cool. Yeah, we'll sit down and watch it. I think it's worthy. If you dig it, we'll talk about it in Summer of 88 as well, because it's, again, what we were talking about last week. There was a big push towards realism in the late 80s. The audiences wanted things that were realistic. We went from the highest grossing films being science fiction, fantasy, and horror films to all of a sudden being legal dramas and biopics, and all of a sudden people wanted real. So when you were giving them horror, because there was still a big push for horror, there was an interest in trying to ground it in reality, and how certain people did that was by relying upon religion. And so here we have a very bizarre little film about the possible end of the world with such a crazy cool cast, such a junk food cast that it is shocking that you didn't know about this one. But again, this was on our maybe list.
See, no, that's actually not true. I owned the VHS of this movie for a long time, and I think I may have even watched it once, but I remembered nothing about it. But this is one that had been on my radar. And what's really interesting in doing this movie right after Die Hard is not only were Demi Moore and Bruce Willis an item, but Demi Moore is pregnant in this movie with their first child, Rumor Willis.
Yeah.
So it's...
And has a famous weird naked pregnant scene in this movie.
Yes.
Which caused a lot of furor at the time. Like, people were really fucking weirded out by that.
But then they would come to realize a few years later that if there's one thing Demi Moore doesn't give a shit about, it's challenging people with being naked and pregnant, because she, of course, had the legendary Vanity Fair cover in 91 with their second child.
Yeah, which was part of a reaction to that. It was kind of a fuck you to the reaction that people had.
Okay, so that's interesting. So that cover exists because of the reaction to what happens in this movie.
Yeah, because people were upset with that, and the argument was, wait, if I showed up full frontal naked in a movie, you guys would pay even more money to come and see it. But if I do it with my carrying my child, doing a natural thing, a natural part of womanhood, all of a sudden you're repulsed by
That's when it becomes taboo.
Yeah. Fuck you.
Yeah.
And so that was, yeah, no, it was really interesting how much she was like, how this one small moment is actually an infusion of feminism into the pop culture in a way that we were not prepared for, that we didn't see coming.
That's interesting.
So it was a very interesting sequence in that movie.
So inadvertently, or maybe tertiarily, this did have a huge pop culture impact.
Yeah, but it's not remembered. And the thing is, I remembered it, and I remember a bunch of parts from it, but it was one of those things where I was like, yeah, I'm sure that movie's not going to hold up. And after I had picked a movie for us to cover, and I sat down to rewatch it, and it was barely a movie. Like, it was, you know, we'll talk about it. I was going to rewatch, I revisited Critters 2.
I was really excited about the idea of covering Critters 2 as part of Summer of 88. And we both were. We were both like, yeah, Critters 2. But after your reaction to revisiting it, I had the horrifying realization that I had only seen the movie once. And had I revisited, I just completely trusted you. I was like, if it's that bad on revisit, I'm not even going to try.
It had been so long since I've watched any of the Critters movies. I had put the best parts of Critters together with Critters 2 and somehow thought that Critters 2 was the good one, because that's the one written by David Toohey and directed by Mick Garris. That's got to be the good one, right? No.
wrong.
It's a movie. It's a movie so batshit crazy that it actually has plot development and plot notes in a jingle for a fucking restaurant. Like, there's actually exposition in...
See, and I feel like people are hearing this and just screaming at their phones like, then why wouldn't junk food cinema cover it? That sounds like exactly your kind of shit.
Yeah, not this time.
Turns out not so much.
So I was like, you know what? I'm going to revisit The Seventh Sign and... Dude, that just revisiting it, I remembered the movie, and yet I did not remember how awesome it was and how great the execution is. And I had forgotten small bits. Like, let's talk about the cast here.
Let's do.
As we've got Demi Moore anchoring this movie, and it is, for a lot of it, there is a lot of angle of this movie that is very much about the domestic life of these two people who are trying to have a child, and they keep failing. And the husband is played by Junk Food alum Michael Biehn.
Junk Food fucking Hall of Famer.
Yes. Yeah. This is in that run. He had done Terminator. He had done Aliens. And then he goes to do this. And this movie, while not being as legendary as the other stuff, is still fucking great. And he's fucking bringing it in this movie.
He really is. I mean, and he's not the same... It's not a typical Michael Biehn character. It's not someone who is out in front leading a team of badasses. It's not someone who you know, is a gun-toting hero. He's a lawyer.
He's
a lawyer with his own story going on.
Yeah, and who means well and who loves his wife and is watching his wife fall apart, believing in crazy conspiracy theories about how some guy has come to murder her child to end the world. Like, yeah. Everything she tells Michael Biehn in this movie sends up red flags of crazy pants. Like, this is one of those rare horror movies where you don't want to grab one of the characters and shake them and go, listen to her. She knows what she's talking about. It's like, you want to put your arm around it and go, dude, your wife is fucking losing it.
Yeah.
Like, cause she isn't getting it. She's making up conspiracy theories and she is in small parts right. But she's got a lot of stuff that she gets wrong, which I find fascinating about this film. It's one of the things that's great about it. She believes this stranger who's come and rented their garage apartment is some guy who wants to end the world by killing her baby. And that is in some parts right and wrong.
We need to talk about who this guy is. That
Jürgen Prochnow.
Jürgen Prochnow, you guys, like, this is another guy who deserves a lot of time on junk food cinema. He's gotten some, but I mean, we're talking about Das Boot, The Keep, Dune, Judge Dredd, Beverly Hills Cop 2. Like, yeah, and you're right. So far, yes, has gotten some time. Air Force One, just like, we could go on and on and on. This is an actor whose presence alone is, I feel like his presence can elevate a lot of otherwise unwatchable things, like just having him in it. And what I like about his character in this movie is we're introduced to him as he's walking along the beaches of Haiti. And
I have to pause for 1 second.
You're
going to Jürgen pause now and tell you that's what it's called from here on out. It's Jürgen pause.
Jürgen pause now.
For the second week in a row, you've ignored In the Mouth of Madness on someone's filmography.
I just hadn't scrolled up that far, goddammit.
I was going to say, it's like, dude, literally, this is the second week in a row I have to mention In the Mouth of Madness, which we covered.
Well, apparently, I don't read enough Sutter Kane.
You need to read more Sutter Kane.
Or maybe our theory about that movie is that certain elements of that story don't really exist in the real world. So maybe I'm forgetting it because I actually exist in the third level
in
of existence.
In a different universe?
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to go. You're going to unpause now. He is walking along the beaches of Haiti, and he brings with him the death of all the fish in the sea around Haiti. So automatically, our antenna are up. We are definitely not trusting this guy. And what I love about the structure of this movie, and I have to say this now, spoiler alert, because we are going to talk about it.
Yeah, we're going to spoil this. And still, even spoiled, you'll still be able to watch it if you're like, you know what, but trust us on this. Who does Jürgen Prochnow play?
Jürgen Prochnow is Jesus.
Jürgen Prochnow is Jesus.
German Jesus.
Who, he never says he's Jesus. And that's, again, brilliance of the structure. They never call him Jesus. You just know he's Jesus.
Yeah.
He has this great line in the movie where who are you? Well, I first came to this world as the lamb, and now I'm back as the lion.
I return as the lion. Oh, so good.
And it's because the entire thing, like when you piece it all together, Jesus came to Earth 2,000 years ago and made the argument to God that man was worth saving. And 2,000 years later, we have proven him wrong. And so he's come back to end the world. But he doesn't really want to end the world. And he really does believe in humanity. And here is this woman who is prophesied to give birth to the first baby without a soul.
Yeah.
It's the whole Judeo-Christian concept of the guff.
Okay, real quick.
You're
going to pause now. Is that a real thing, or is that a reference to a MacGuffin? Because I want to know this, because the more they talked about the guff in this movie, and because it's introduced after Michael Biehn literally says, I don't believe all that guff, and I realize that that's where I've probably heard the word guff more often than not, was from older people in my life, like all that bullshit, all that whatever, all that guff. And so it just, when they started talking about the guff being like a finite amount of souls in the world, and when the guff is empty, guff, 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 I was like, is it MacGuffin? Is that just a shortened version, or is that a real concept?
No, it's really the word guff, which is from Hebrew.
Okay.
It's spelled usually G-U-P-H, or even in some phrases, G-U-P.
Got it.
But it is now spelled G-U-F. But yes, no, it is from Jewish traditions. It is one of those, there is this whole kind of subsection of Judeo-Christian mythology that you have to call Judeo-Christian mythology, because technically the Catholics have absorbed a bunch of this stuff, but a lot of it isn't considered canon. And it's very weird. There's a lot of the stuff, especially with like King Solomon, is accepted by Jewish traditions, of, you know, King Solomon and enslaving all these demons to do this work to create his temples, and this magic ring that Solomon owned that allowed him to control demons. Like, this is all stuff that come from Jewish texts. Now, modern Judaism acknowledges that a lot of these stories are just stories. They're just stories that we told to get these things. They are not necessarily canon. And then you get to Catholicism, which absorbed a bunch of stuff and said, no, it's real. And then ultimately over time, various popes are like, yeah, no, these are just stories. But then a lot of that gets filtered down to Christianity and Protestantism, where they accept it as, you know, anything that is here is chapter and verse. So there is a lot of stuff in this Judeo-Christian section of mythology that you can say, yes, this stuff is legitimately like part of the traditions. But does anyone believe it? Not so much.
Like, so my question for theology is Batman the Animated Series considered canon? Because if you ignore it entirely, then how do you explain Harley Quinn? Because she was created for the show.
Batman the Animated Series is canon.
Have you seen Jesus the Animated Series? Because that show was quickly canceled.
On the Armed Forces Network?
On the Armed Forces Network. It was quickly canceled. But apologies to any theologians who are listening. I don't imagine there,
especially since they're pronounced theologians.
Whatever. I don't imagine there are a lot of you, because the amount of Dutch Rudder references on the show would probably send you screaming away from your computer. But I want to get a background sense of all of this, because there is a lot that's kind of thrown at you in this movie.
Oh yes,
and it's not clear how much of it is actual theology and how much of it might just be constructed for this narrative. So I was just curious.
Speaking of that,
which we are,
this whole thing, that notion is brought up by another great actor who has a super small appearance in this movie, one scene, but it is it's a classic scene. It's the type of scene that you get in a lot of films. I wrote one into Sinister 2 that sadly got butchered. It started out as a 10-page bit and became a 5-page bit, and then became 2.5 pages in a confessional. But it is the scene of, we need to go and talk to a priest and have a priest explain it to us. And in my version, I was kind of taking the piss out of all the various times I'd seen this scene, while also kind of using that power, because there is a power to, I'm going to sit down and talk to a priest about this. But who plays that priest, my friend?
John Hurd.
The great John Hurd in his youth.
Yeah.
Like, this is in his early days, but he plays this priest and is essentially kind of explaining that, hey, all this stuff about the guff, it's just a story. And these are just stories to help us understand our faith. And he's really great in that scene.
As the Catholic priest with his head screwed on, right?
Like, yeah.
It's very interesting.
Yeah. But who's also kind of doesn't believe in all the, doesn't believe that, you know, what's going on. Because at this point, nobody acknowledges, in fact, only one person by the end of the movie even has an inkling as to who Jürgen Prochnow really is. Nobody believes that Jesus has come back.
Yeah, exactly. And I want to just throw this out there really quickly. The music in this movie is done by Jack Nitzsche, who a lot of you probably know as the guy who did the music for Death Proof, which is outstanding music. But he's a guy whose name keeps coming up in movies I've been watching recently. Like, I just recently saw Paul Schrader's Hardcore, which is a phenomenal fucking movie, and take a drink.
Hardcore has been on the list for a long time.
But because of that, I did expect that the priest was going to be played by George C. Scott. I kept waiting for George C. Scott to show up and just be like, ah, goddamn, these are mostly stories.
Why did you do that to me? Like,
because we love John Hurd, but now you're just thinking about George C. Scott. It's because of fucking Exorcist 3 that we're even having this discussion. But
yeah,
still.
But Exorcist 3, again, by the way, if you want an amazing Catholic triple feature of the late 80s, Exorcist 3, The Seventh Sign, and The Unholy all together create a universe that I want to believe is the same universe. Like, it is just such a great series of Catholic horror films.
And then you cap that off with something more modern. I'm going to throw some love to your boy, Deliver Us From Evil, which I really, really liked.
I really love Deliver Us From Evil as well. Like, I have a big warm soft spot.
If it weren't a blatant conflict of interest, I would love to do that movie on this show.
Yeah, no, like as much as I avoid other conflicts of interest, I can't cover. Or you know what? Maybe I can. Maybe, you know what? If we can, when we finally get Scott here to Austin, let's have Scott do an episode with us and talk about Deliver Us From Evil.
I love that.
That's the way we can get away with it, by doing an interview with my buddy about this film.
Well, because thou shalt not shill.
It's in the junk food codex.
It is.
The codex junkfoodicus.
Yes, and in the briefcase will always be the guff. I don't know what that means, but we're going to go ahead.
So, by the way, let's explain the guff.
Yeah.
The concept of the guff is that—
It's terrifying!
It is part of the mythology that, you know, heaven is essentially— If you envision heaven as a great palace, one of those halls in the palace is the Hall of Souls, which is where all the unborn souls are kept. And the unborn souls are there all milling about, swirling about. And every time there's a birth, a soul is taken and escorted down by angels and put into the soul of a child. And they are born. And there's, you know, of course, in Catholicism, they believe that the soul enters at conception, so that you have a soul whether you make it through or not, which is why Catholics are so detrimental, you know, diametrically opposed to abortion, because they believe there's already a soul there. And this all comes back from this, you know, 3,000-4,000 year old belief of the guff. So the idea is that the guff has a finite number of souls, that the end of times, the final sign, the seventh sign that will be seen, that will usher in the Armageddon, is that the final soul from the guff will have left, and then a single child will be born without a soul, and that will trigger the end of the world. And Demi Moore is carrying that baby.
Which I completely agree with, because the concept of biting into a Cadbury egg and there is no filling in the middle, that is my end of days. So I totally get behind this, but it is, in all seriousness, a really scary concept.
What is this fucking chocolate you're giving me? How dare you just give me chocolate?
Is this hollow chocolate ball? What the fuck is wrong with you? That's not what I paid for. And then the world ends. That's kind of how I saw it anyway. But no, the idea that there is only a finite number of souls, but people are going to keep being born without souls. Like, if the world didn't end, what would that look like? What would that generation look like? That's a really terrifying idea, is that those children without souls grow up and there is a whole generation of people that are soulless. And then I just realized, I think I've described America currently, but I've described the internet.
You described Gen Xers.
Yeah. I've described subredditors, I think. I'm not entirely sure, but so what I love about the structure of this movie, and it's great that we mentioned Michael Biehn already, because this movie, and I know it was released 3 years before, this movie pulls off something that I can only compare to the opening of Terminator 2. If you can imagine that you saw Terminator 2 in a theater and you had never seen a piece of marketing, never seen a trailer, had no concept other than the first Terminator, there is a brilliance to how the first 10 minutes of Terminator 2 was structured. Because all we know of Arnold Schwarzenegger from the first Terminator is that he's an evil robot from the future. And the other person we see come back in time immediately takes on the persona of a police officer, and they even deliberately show the shield on the side of the car that says to protect and serve. And those two people are simultaneously coming after John Connor, and we don't know what either of their motivations are except for our preconceived notions. And that scene where the two of them converge on John Connor and they pull their guns, it is not until Schwarzenegger tells Connor to get down that we realize the police officer is the bad guy, and the Terminator robot Schwarzenegger is actually the protector.
And that has the best, that's the scene with the best subtle joke in the movie, where he pulls a gun out of his box of roses.
Yes, absolutely, right? So this movie has something very similar, where for most of the movie, you're assuming Jürgen Prochnow is evil, and this—
He's the angel of death.
He's the angel of death.
And this priest tracking him down is actually the guy who's going to help Demi Moore.
That's what you think. That's what you believe. And there comes a point in this movie where you realize, oh no, the priest who spends a lot of this movie, by the way, trying to convince everyone that the things that have happened are hoaxes. And it's not because he doesn't believe the world is ending. It's that he doesn't want anyone doing anything to stop it.
Yes, because we find out he's a famous figure from Christian mythology, the Wandering Jew. He is this Roman soldier who struck Jesus and was cursed by God to never be able to die. And he's shown up in a bunch of other media. This is one of my favorite iterations of him. He is this guy who's been living for 2,000 years and can't die and knows the only way he can die is when the world ends. And so he is all about humanity damning themselves. He hates humanity. He's ready to go. He is trying to stop Jesus.
Yeah. Yeah, and that turn where you realize it's a lot like the Terminator 2 moment where you're like, holy shit, the guy I assumed was the villain, because it's Jürgen Prochnow, and you're well within your right to assume that if Jürgen Prochnow shows up in a movie,
he's fucking creepy,
and he's got you know, nefarious means on
this
someone.
This might be creepiest Jesus ever. Like, really, in terms of performances of Jesus, I don't know that Jesus has ever been this weird and creepy.
Creepiest Jesus ever. There's your fucking BuzzFeed article.
Like, there it is.
20 gifts that prove Jürgen Prochnow is the creepiest Jesus of all time. I would probably get paid to write that article, unfortunately. Yeah, no, I do love that turn where we realize that this priest is not who he says he is, and that Jürgen Prochnow is actually... And all of this entire movie, the strength of this movie really hinges upon Demi Moore's performance. Like, there is a lot asked of her in this movie.
Everyone in this movie is leaving it out on the field.
Yeah.
Like, that's what's so interesting about this film, is this is a movie that was made with a rising star to be an A-list horror movie. And everybody fucking brings it. Prochnow's bringing it. Bean is bringing it. She's really bringing it. She is unhinged in this movie. She's losing it. Mm-hmm. And you, as much as you know what's really going on, you still are like, girl, you crazy.
Yeah.
Like, you're fucking nuts. Like, yeah. You're taking some leaps of logic here, and you're somewhat right, but oh my God, you're wrong. We haven't even, you know what? We haven't even gotten to the most batshit part of this movie yet.
We haven't, but I do want to, just jumping off the point you just made.
Okay.
I'm somebody who recently, my wife was pregnant. Our son's about to turn one. I remember what it was like to have a pregnant wife, and she was at times the evil Knievel when it came to leaps of logic. Like, it was, you know, it's the kind of thing that there was part of me watching this movie going, I remember like how hard it was sometimes to, like, take every concern seriously, because everything was a concern, which is, it makes total sense when you're talking about something as delicate as creating a life. And I get that. But what you're saying right now is something I definitely connected with in this movie, because, yeah, like the amount of crazy that can be amped up sometimes when some women get pregnant is pretty remarkable. I'll give you that.
Oddly enough, you know what we also haven't talked about? We haven't talked about the writers of this movie.
Yeah. What's going on with this? Because these are writers writing this movie under aliases.
Yeah, and it might be how this happens is writers, unlike directors, can change their name at any point in time. You can legally change your name on any production. You can only remove your name from a production if you were paid less than, I think it's $250,000 in this day and age. I think that's the, like, if you're paid $250,000 or $200,000, you cannot remove your name. You can only change it. So if they changed their name, it's quite possible they were unhappy with how the script then turned out. Because that's usually what happens, is you do it as an act of protest. Like, fuck this movie. This isn't what I intended. I'm changing my name. Sometimes you get other people who do it, like John Carpenter does it, to just kind of pull attention off of him. And he has his own cover name that he writes under.
Richard Bachman.
Yeah. No. And that was done for a different reason, but we talked about that in a different episode. But yeah, no. So these people, they're credited with, they made one other Christian horror movie, Bless the Child, which is interesting. And then they made, of course, the 1986 movie Space Camp, which is a movie I feel like at some point.
We're definitely gonna cover it. But my theory on what was going on here is that there was, because they were dealing with a subject that could, if they were very religious folk, put them at risk of being labeled as blasphemous. So my first thought is they were intentionally writing under pseudonyms to avoid the potential of being, like, if there was a big backlash against this movie from the religious right, to kind of protect themselves. That was because I understand what you're saying about writers changing their names, but this is not adding an initial. This is not, changing a last name after marriage, whatever. This is two writers writing under completely false names. The real writers are Clifford Green and Ellen Green, writing as George Kaplan and W.W. Wicket. There seems to be almost a witness protection level of pseudonym going on here. And I can't think of any other reason you would do that other than you're worried about the reaction of something. Like,
no, no.
But why do that then?
Well, I mean, really, for the reason of, just to remove your name and not have that credit, your name be recognized by people. I mean, the internet didn't exist, so it wasn't like people were going to look up and be able to see, oh, this is really this person writing.
Yeah.
So I don't think they were worried about backlash.
To me, it's so bizarre.
But it's not the type of movie that would inspire backlash because it's not like they do anything blasphemous in it.
No, but there is something we need to talk about. It's the first thing I said to you when I came in today.
This is where we were going here, and let's get here.
This movie has balls. Like,
big balls.
Holy God.
Like, for those of you who have not seen the movie yet and you're like, wait, I thought the Jürgen Prochnow now is Jesus was ballsy. Oh, no.
No. So this movie hinges on, the reason it's called The Seventh Sign is because that there are all of these specific prophesied signals that the world is coming to an end. And by the way, how pissed off were the makers of this movie that the seventh seal was already a title that was taken? Because every time something happens that is one of these signs, what does Jürgen Prochnow now do? He breaks a seal on a piece of paper.
I've called this The Seventh Seal for a long time, and it's like, no. The Seventh Seal is a classic fucking film.
It's Ingmar Bergman.
It's The Seventh Sign, and I always have to correct myself because for that very reason. He goes right. He's got these great clay seals on these hand scrawled scrolls, and he breaks the seal, and then something crazy happens. The rivers fill with blood, and the sea starts to boil, and the fish wash up on sea still fucking roasted. Like, she accidentally steps on one and cracks it, and there's a fucking violent earthquake.
Yeah.
Like, this is crazy shit happens. But the last two seals are, of course, the last two signs are, one, the final child born from the guff, and two, the sixth sign is the death of the last martyr.
And this is where this movie refuses to pull a punch, because the last martyr, as depicted in this movie, happens to be Michael Biehn's client, who is accused of and has confessed to murdering his parents by setting them on fire while they slept because they were brother and sister. And that that incestuous relationship has led to
an extra chromosome or two.
So this character is in jail on death row and has Down syndrome.
Yeah.
This movie, in this story, is set to execute someone with Down syndrome, which immediately I was like, so this must be set in Texas. Apparently it's not.
California.
It's California. But what's crazy is that you watch this movie and you watch all of these people refuse an appeal to save the life of someone with Down syndrome on death row.
Because he refuses to talk to psychologists or psychiatrists.
Because he thinks that would be admitting that he's wrong, and he understands that what he did was in accordance with God's law, and that's what makes him a martyr.
Yeah, and that's the crazy thing about this movie is there's an evil kid with Down syndrome in this that believes he's right.
It's
because the Bible says, and the movie doesn't actually make the distinction. That's what's so fucking crazy about this is the movie never says, yeah, he was wrong for doing it. Instead, it's like, no, he's a martyr. He's dying for his faith. He's dying for what he believes is right, which is,
and that's the thing.
The Bible says you can actually kill sinners to punish them for their sins. And he believes that. So he set his parents on fire for being brother and sister.
Which is the crazy thing about martyrdom is, like, nowhere in the definition of a martyr do you have to be right. It's about dying for what you believe. So that's really fascinating. And also, as crazy as it is to say this, despite what I've just said happens in this movie, it's not exploitative in the slightest.
No. No, it's actually very heartfelt. Like, Michael Biehn really wants to save this kid. He really wants to get him off death row. He really wants him to spend his life in an institution. There's also a certain, there's a certain arrogance to that, which I also kind of admire, is that he believes he's the good liberal guy saving a guy, because, well, he's handicapped, so he really doesn't know what he was doing. And this kid, listening to him, no, this kid's crazy as fuck, but not because he has Down syndrome.
No.
Like, this guy just is literally a religious zealot who believes that setting his parents on fire was okay because the Bible says it's okay. Like, and his flaws have nothing to do with his disorder. Like, he is, that's not, and this movie is very clear about that. Like, this guy is just a believer. And this is both the power and danger of that kind of extreme faith. It is very, very interesting how it's handled.
It's just, you imagine this story in someone else's hands and how easily a pregnant woman jumping in front of the bullet shot by a priest who's trying to kill someone with Down syndrome who's on death row. That sounds...
That's the climax of this fucking movie. That, and oh, by the way, Jesus is there.
That sounds like a horrible drive-in movie that nobody should see.
And yet, it's a very, very elegantly executed, wonderful taste of late 80s horror.
And I think that is the key word here. A lot of this movie, elegant is the perfect way to describe it. The dream sequences that Demi Moore has are really beautiful. Like, it feels almost Lynchian in the way that it's shot, and it's just... It's so interesting, and it
ties into the Geostorm universe.
Thank you. Oh my god, I've been sitting on that for like 30 minutes.
I imagine the minute I saw it that you were going to be like, Geostorm ties in here somewhere.
And it came back again when you started talking about the Wandering Jew. Is that the name of the character from Theology? Because that's two Gerard Butler tie-ins. I'm just going to point that out. One of the early signs in this movie is that a meteorologist is brought out to the desert by a government. He's like, why am I here? Why am I here? And they're like, well, we want you to investigate this village. We thought it was a haven for terrorists. He's like, well, again, why am I here? And we get there to this village in the Middle East that has been frozen solid. And I'm like, oh, it's not Jesus. It's not the devil. It's Dutch Boy. Dutch Boy is to blame for everything that's happening in this movie. Open your eyes, people. Someone has taken over Dutch Boy.
Dutch Boy is not my problem anymore.
What really is awesome that happens is they're like, well, yeah, this terrorist camp was built on a city where this happened before. And it's like, what was it? It was called Sodom.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, that's fucking cool.
It really is. And then, of course, when you were talking about this character from Theology who struck Jesus and then was cursed to never die, I'm like... Isn't that exactly the big plot twist of Dracula 2000? Is that you find out that Dracula's actually Judas and he's cursed because he betrayed Jesus and then he was cursed to never die? Spoiler alert, that's exactly the big plot twist of Dracula 2000, starring Gerard Butler as Dracula, a.k.a. Judas Iscariot.
A.k.a. Dracula 2000.
A.k.a. big monster magnet fan. That fucking movie
D2K!
There's a word I wanted to use to describe that movie that I won't because a character in this movie... Anyway.
How is that not the posters for that movie? How is it not just D2K? How is it...
D2K.
Dracula 2000.
Because,
D2K.
Because people would get confused and think they were watching another Mighty Ducks sequel. And that's what they were trying to avoid, I feel. Throughout this entire movie... the supernatural things that keep happening, and every time something supernatural happens, there's Jürgen Prochnow in the background just doing his creepy Jesus bit, and you're convinced, they do such a good job convincing you that he has nefarious designs on Demi Moore and her baby. And because they have created a character who has lost a baby and who is very concerned about, I believe they call it like placental insufficiency or something, about a danger to her current child, you completely buy into her belief that, in fact, he is out to get her. Now, something I actually wanted to bring up, and I want to give a big shout out to one of our researchers who dug this up, and I didn't know about this. Kevin actually dug this up. Apparently, we've been talking about the fact that she was pregnant with Rumor Willis in this movie. Apparently, there is some doubt about that, because this movie likely shot in 1987. Rumor Willis wasn't born until August of 1988. So the math doesn't quite work out. And apparently there was an interview with a show called City Lights in Canada where the host asked Demi Moore how she got into the mindset of a pregnant woman because she wouldn't have actually been pregnant at the time. And Demi Moore gave an answer about getting into just like really trying to understand where she would have been coming from. So there's apparently a little bit of controversy about whether she was actually pregnant during
the
movie.
She may have done reshoots with it.
For
that shot could have easily been a reshoot, because there's a lot of this movie where it looks like, because I was actually surprised rewatching this, because I hadn't remembered that detail about that with the story. And it looked very much like she had the padding on.
Mm-hmm.
She was wearing the padding during shoots.
In the scenes where she's wearing clothes.
Yeah. She didn't look like she was really pregnant.
I say that as if it's not most of this movie.
And then there's that shot of her pregnant.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh shit, if that's prosthesis, it's a great fucking prosthesis.
I hadn't considered reshoots. That's interesting.
But it's entirely possible that particular shot and a few other things were done in reshoots. But the story that I always knew was that it was legit, that she was actually pregnant, because I was reminded of that when that came up. And I was like, oh yeah, no, that's real. Like, that's, oh shit, this is her first baby. Oh yeah, I remember all this now. Because so much of this I had forgotten. Like, I remembered, like, this is where I learned about the guff, and this is where I learned about certain Judeo-Christian traditions. You know, this is my first exposure to the concept of the wandering Jew, the wandering Roman. And so I remembered those elements, but I had forgotten so much, and that until I saw that. And I was like, there's a moment where it's like, is that real? And if it's not real, if it is prosthesis, fuck, is that prosthesis fucking great?
Yeah.
Because dear God, it looks like fucking pregnant Demi
Moore. No, I think your theory is probably more correct, that she wasn't pregnant for most of the shoot and then did reshoots while she was pregnant. Like that to me, given the release of this movie in the summer of 88, which means it would have shot months before, because she is very pregnant in that scene. It's not an early, if she was really pregnant when they shot this, you know, months before, she is very far along in that scene. So I think that is probably more likely the reshoot scenario. Also, did you notice the very unusual, very unexpected junk food cinema tie-in?
Which one?
At one point, someone is watching on TV Band
of the Hand.
Of the Hand.
Yes.
What? I was like, wait, what? That's fucking Band of the Hand, and they're just watching it on TV like it's not Band of the Hand, when it most definitely is Band of the Hand.
Fucking Band of the Hand.
Band of the Hand. So exciting. No, I got a big kick out of that. But yeah, I really, like, everything, as this movie ramps up and we keep getting to that point, it's crazy how invested, like, the scene that we were talking about with Demi Moore pregnant and naked, the thing that we're not talking about is the fact that that scene is her contemplating suicide. Like,
yes,
this movie gets real heavy and real, like, it's the characters and the stories that they're, or the challenges that they're facing really suck you into this thriller.
This is a horror movie that doesn't have many deaths.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not the impending fear of characters dying that fucks with you. It is, I would say no deaths, but no, there's a moment where our priest strangles out another priest. And it's a really interesting sequence, because you have this old priest who sees this guy and he's like, wait, you look like a friend of mine from like 45 years ago. Like, yeah, this is nuts. You sound like him too. No, you're thinking of a different guy. You realize this guy's been pretending to be a priest in the Catholic Church for centuries.
Yeah.
Like, this is nuts. But yeah, then he strangles out that priest and has that, you know, you always were too nosy for your own good, Harold. And it's that first moment that you realize, oh my God, this guy's immortal. Fuck. It's really cool. But yeah, this movie, it gets all its tension based off the promised ending, like the end of the world could come and it's all on this woman's shoulders. And the way that works is just so well done.
And I love the scene where she ends up stabbing Jürgen Prochnow, still thinking that he is after her, after the baby. And just the way that the outcome of that is filmed, where the hole just starts emanating light, and she kind of gets consumed by it, and you start to realize who he really is.
You just stabbed Jesus, bitch.
You stabbed Jesus. And by the way, there is a scene where the three of them are having dinner, and a sparrow flies through the room, and Michael Biehn says to Jürgen Prochnow, "Jesus Christ, did you see that? Was it Jesus Christ, comma? Did you see that? Was it him just shouting out an expletive, or was he specifically asking Jürgen Prochnow?"
I feel like that's probably something that Michael Biehn ad-libbed. He goes, "You know, it would be funny." Jesus Christ, did you see that?
Come on, Jesus, assholes and elbows. No, I definitely think that was very much intentional, but it did definitely make me laugh. The thing that I didn't even mention in the final scene where a pregnant woman steps in front of the bullet fired by a priest at a kid with Down syndrome on death row is that she gets hit and the kid still gets hit. Like, you want to talk about defying expectations? First of all, that entire scene, everything I just said, is like, I never in my life thought I would see in a movie. And not only that, but it's like she gets hit. You think the heroic moment has happened, and then she rolls over and sees that he's still dead.
Yeah.
That's fucking brutal.
Because the whole, and what this whole movie comes to is the signs have to happen. All seven signs have to happen, whether the world ends or the world resets. That's the whole big kicker here is Jesus needs this one woman to be willing to make a sacrifice for the rest of the world, the way he did. That you need to be willing to die and in order to save the rest of the world. Will you do that? And that's what he's essentially asking her the whole movie. And when it comes to it, she, you know, yes, I'm willing to die to save this soul. And as a result, with that death, the guff refills and the world is set anew.
So really, going back to the Terminator comparison, you can't stop Judgment Day. Judgment Day is going to happen. So in this case, it's the actual judgment of the Lord and not the uprising of Skynet. But still, I'm going with this comparison because it helps me understand religion better, which Terminator has always done. So I'm just going to stick with that for sure. But that's the real heartbreaking part about the ending of this movie is that you realize you've been told from very early on what's going to happen, and you either didn't notice or didn't want it to be true, but Demi Moore's character has to die to save the world. And then that scene, you know, at the end where her baby is delivered and they hand the baby to Michael Biehn, and there's just, I can't even imagine the horrible conflict of emotions in that character at that time, to be so happy that your child is born and yet heartbroken that your wife has died. Like, I can't even imagine, like, that it's grueling, like, to watch. And like, I'm sure it was difficult to perform, but it really, like, there is so much weight in the character arcs of this movie that you forget for a while that it is a religious thriller and you start focusing on just these people. And again, I think that's a lot of credit is deserved from Demi Moore and Michael Biehn, because they really do act their asses off in this movie.
Yeah, they sell the shit out of it.
And one actor who actually, something that I thought was interesting, Ellen DeGeneres shot a scene for this movie, which would have been her first on-screen appearance, and it got cut. So
I didn't know that.
I'm not sure where in the movie that would have happened, but apparently, yeah, she was supposed to be in the movie and the scene got cut, which is kind of an interesting little tidbit. Also, there's a moment in this movie right when Jürgen Prochnow shows up and he introduces himself, and the alias that he gives is David Bannon.
Yeah.
But I thought he said David Banner, and I start immediately could not stop thinking about Jürgen Prochnow as the Hulk. I desperately wish that in the mid-80s we had gotten a Jürgen Prochnow Hulk, because holy shit, I would have watched that. I would have, TV show or movie, I don't even care. I just want a Jürgen Prochnow Hulk. I don't think I'm asking too much. I don't think it's too much to ask. And that brings us to the junk food pairing. I have nothing. Do you have an idea on what to do for this? Because I am so lost in the woods here.
You know what? I do.
All right, go for it.
I do. The junk food pairing for this is a potluck.
Oh.
Now, here's the thing about growing up Catholic.
There you go. Yeah.
lots of potlucks. Lots of everybody cook the thing that you and your family are known for, and you bring it to the potluck, you put it all out, and you just have a big old plate of fucking everything. And that kind of is what this movie is. This movie is not just, it's taking a little bit of everything in religion and a little bit of everything in terms of craziness and putting it all together in a movie, and it just works. Like, it's a bunch of things that if you put on a menu and said, we're serving all this together, like, Brian said, no fucking way. That climax, I would think that was one of the worst fucking drive-in movie endings of all time. But instead, it really does work, because when you put your heart into something, when you put your soul into something, and you bring it all together as a potluck, you create something that is communal, and you create something that is great. And you may not remember it as one of the best meals of your life, but there's a lot of greatness there. And that is the essence of The Seventh Sign. It is not going to be remembered as one of the greatest movies ever made. Will not even be remembered as one of the greatest Catholic movies ever made. But it's really great and underappreciated, and it's a lot of people bringing what they do best together and making something that is really good.
Yeah, I have to apologize to one of our researchers, Kevin, who went to all the trouble to specifically lay out what the guff is in his research, and I just forgot to read it.
You didn't read it?
I didn't read it. That's my bad. He specifically found and wrote down, in Jewish mysticism, the guff is the Hall of Souls located in the seventh heaven, which is not a problematic TV show that you can't watch anymore. Every human soul is said to emanate from the guff. So, Kevin, you are absolutely right, and I am terrible. So thank you so much for doing the legwork on that. I also realized that I think that is a great junk food pairing. I also think the really twisted junk food pairing is the one I accidentally came up with during the show about a Cadbury egg with no filling. So take your pick, guys. We've given you a lot to work with here, much as this movie gives us a lot to work with. And I'm going to tie this into Die Hard one more way, because you might remember we talked about Ebert's review of Die Hard and how he got fixated on the chief of police character, and that really brought down his entire review. He did something similar with this one, where he found the movie overall to be good, but he talked about the problematic ending, and I thought, well, maybe he's talking about, I don't know, murdering someone with Down syndrome. I can understand how that would maybe...
Oh, I guess not.
But that's not what he was talking
about.
What
is the problematic ending, Brian?
According to Ebert, he said, I'm going to go at this very delicately so as to not to give too much away, but if you see the film, ask yourself this. When the baby reaches out his hand toward the mother's face, why doesn't he simply touch it? If you see what I mean. I don't know what he means. Is he making a reference to like the Virgin Mary and baby Jesus touching the face of Virgin? I don't understand. He says that as if everyone's going to understand immediately what he's talking about. And I don't know what he's talking about.
I don't either.
That didn't bother me. There was nothing.
Babies aren't really great with direction.
Neither is Uwe Boll. So, you know, they have that in common. Guys, thank you so much for joining us on this discussion of The Seventh Sign. Again, not The Seventh Seal and not German Jesus, which is another alternate title for this film, in my mind, at least. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
On Twitter and Instagram, at Massaworm, MASSAWYRM.
Awesome. You can find me on Twitter, at BryGuySalisbury. Again, this show, at Junk Food Cinema. And again, we are going to be appearing at Denver Comic Con June 15th through the 17th, doing a live show. We are also going to be at Convergence in Minneapolis the weekend after July 4th. Cargill is going to be at Cinemapocalypse in Chicago at the Music Box Theater. And some other, where
and I've
else?
Got a new book coming out.
New book.
We Are Where the Nightmares Go. It is a collection of 10 horror stories. Some comedy, some dark, some fun. And it's available wherever you buy books.
Do any of those stories involve Jürgen Prochnow as the Hulk?
No.
I feel like we've all failed.